History's not like something like math. It's something that can have potentially many right answers and many different perspectives and many different ways to look at things. And what that means is sometimes when you're taking a tour through the past, the guide that you have at the time is key. And you can take the same tour multiple times, but if you have a different guide, they'll point out different things, emphasize different things. How often have you read two different books on the same historical event and gotten different perspectives? The perspective of the storyteller matters. Whether you like history or not, if you care about things like bravery and wisdom and passion and larger-than-life characters and some of the most emotionally intense moments in the human experience, well, you've come to the right place and a chance to get a perspective from a different kind of historical tour guide. Daniele Bellelli is a university history professor, a writer, a martial artist, a philosopher, and it provides a very different sort of tour guide through the past than you normally encounter. In this tour, he'll be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
This episode of History on Fire is brought to you by BlueApron.com. Tonight, just a few minutes ago before I sat down to record this introduction, History on Fire producer, editor, and resident muse Savannah M. cooked an amazing Blue Apron meal. We had seared steak and mushroom sauce. And while we were at it, we had a glass of red wine while listening to good old reggae classics, Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. And while we were at it, we also shared a kiss. So, yeah, life could be worse right now. So, thank you, Blue Apron, for sponsoring this episode and for being part of what so far has been a very happy night for me. Blue Apron is offering History on Fire listener $30 off your first order. So, check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/onfire. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. History on Fire is also brought to you by Cannaway. Cannaway makes the highest quality CBD oil at the lowest prices. All their CBD products are organic, non-GMO, European hemp grown, and they're really, really good, I can tell you that. You know, I'm a big fan of CBD. If you guys don't know, you know, CBD oil is basically kind of magic when it comes to reducing inflammation in the body. It's extremely effective. Unlike other cannabis products such as THC, CBD oil is legal to use and possess in all 50 states and Europe. Cannaway in particular uses a type of CBD that, you know, they tested to make sure that it's completely THC free, so that they actually, even people who are into competitive sports can use it, because it doesn't qualify as a drug the way, you know, THC would. Personally, I like this stuff a lot. You know, I know many, many people who have been helped by the use of CBD oil, both in terms of reducing inflammation, regulating memory, helping with appetite, mood, anxiety, you name it. So I dig it. I'm experimenting with it. So what I would suggest you guys do, if you want to check it out, you can go to cannaway.com/2496006. Cannaway is spelled KANNAWAY.com/2496006. Earlier today, I had the pleasure to sit with Aubrey Marcos, the CEO of Onnit, who has been one of the supporters of the show from day one. Aubrey just published a book called Own the Day, Own Your Life. It's his first book. Aubrey is an excellent writer, but this is the first time he actually publishes a book. if you want to, you know, I don't want to take too much time before we get started, so I'll try to make it quick. Just check it out. You know, if nothing else, go on Amazon, take a look at the reviews, take a look at if the book sounds interesting to you. And if it does, well, that's a good guy to support, considering everything he has been doing for the show. And of course, while you are at it, if you want to go to onnit.com/history, onnit.com/history, you'll receive an automatic discount on the many, many supplements that Onnit produces and are quite excellent. Now, speaking of people who have been good to me, Mr. Chris O'Dell from That's Usara, he has been also in my corner from day one. Love Chris. He has been super helpful to my work, to my podcast and everything else. And also makes some amazing products. I've been using at least one, if not more, That's Usara product every single day of my life for the last 6 years. So check them out at the letter D, the letter S, the word gear.com, dsgear.com. Also a big thank you for the support from the podcast How It Began, A History of the Modern World, produced and hosted by historian Brad Harris. Brad has a unique ability to take big historical ideas about modern progress and make them easy to understand in an extremely entertaining way. So check it out. They have, one of my favorite episodes is about a topic I never really thought of before, the technology of refrigeration, which may sound mundane, but Brad managed to lead us through 4 centuries of struggle to harness the power of cold, from the scientific revolution to superconductivity. So what I would suggest is check it out. It's How It Began, A History of the Modern World by Brad Harris, available everywhere. And of course, his website is howitbegan.com. Couple of quick shout-outs also to nevertapgear.com. What they have been making are knee braces for people who work out. I use them all the time. We are also talking about possibly making rash guards together and other products for martial artists, so that's on the horizon. And also a shout out to revolutionspirits.com. They just sent me a bottle of gin, some Amaro, and a few other goodies that they produce. So if you like good spirits, check them out at revolutionspirits.com. Thank you very much for the gift. Now, if you didn't catch any of the above websites, the links are in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. At the end of the episodes, I'll mention a couple of things regarding upcoming episodes. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. So a couple of introductory remarks about today's episode. In the last couple of episodes, the one that I did about the Sand Creek Massacre and the one that Daryl Cooper did about the My Lai Massacre, we laid some pretty heavy foundation on which to build upon. Now, when I say build upon, it's because today's episode is basically trying to tackle the beast that has been unleashed when we are discussing those stories. You know, those episodes were narrative tales, sort of what we normally do with History on Fire, right? Tell you a story from beginning to end. But in this case, I didn't just want to tell you two horrible stories and leave you hanging with that, because there's, you know, I don't see the point in it, that just whipping ourselves with something really heavy. And I also want to try to learn something from it, trying to see what we make of all the horror and tragedy, but also heroism that we saw in those couple of episodes. So today is a different kind of story. We are not going through a narrative episode like we normally do. And I use the word we because in this case it's not going to be just me. It's going to be a cooperative effort of 3 people. I had the privilege of being able to sit down with Daryl Cooper from the Martyr Made podcast, which by now you guys know from that episode that he did on My Lai for History on Fire. But also, we traveled down to San Diego to meet with Mr. Jocko Willink. Jocko needs no introduction, probably. Many of you guys know him already. But if you don't, beside being the host of the Jocko podcast, Jocko is a retired Navy SEAL, knows very much on a first, on a first name basis warfare. He has been in some of the harshest situation in Iraq. So we wanted to chat with Joko a little bit because his understanding of leadership and what makes men snap under pressure in combat, whereas what makes other people being able to stay true to their principles, is something that clearly neither Daryl or I can have. You know, we don't have that direct experience. So of course what Joko brings to the table is very unique, and I very much enjoy sitting down with him to chat. So what you're gonna get is the discussion that the three of us had trying to learn something from the kind of stories that we presented to you so far.
Daniele, Jocko, everybody, I'm here. Daryl Cooper, talking to two of my favorite people. We're going to go some dark places today. You've listened to the last two podcasts that Daniele and I have put out, and maybe about 60% of the podcast that Jocko's put out, then you know we're going to dive into some dark places. I want to get it started pretty quick. We've been talking beforehand, so let's just jump right into it. Daniele and I recently did a series that we cooperated on where he covered the Sand Creek Massacre in 1864. Some U.S. Army soldiers massacred some Native Americans in Colorado. I did the My Lai Massacre, similar situation 104 years later in the jungles of Vietnam. We're fortunate enough to be here with Jocko. If you don't know who Jocko is, I guess we'll go ahead and let you introduce yourself just a little bit.
Yeah, my name is Jocko Willink. I was in the military for 20 years and retired in 2010. And now I've written a couple books and have a podcast called Jocko Podcast because I don't get really creative with the names of things. So
Jocko's pretty direct about things, so he's also kind of humble. Jocko is a Navy SEAL commander in Iraq. He led Task Force Bruiser, is that right?
Into Task Unit Bruiser,
Task Unit Bruiser into the Battle of Ramadi. Which, if you know anything about the war in Iraq, you know the Battle of Ramadi and the Battle of Fallujah are probably the two big fights that get mentioned the most. But whereas Fallujah was more of a direct assault on the city after the insurgents captured and tortured and mutilated some U.S. contractors and Bush ordered the Marines to retaliate, the Battle of Ramadi was a little bit different. Jocko's going to talk a little bit about the environment that they went into going into it. And so he's got some military experience, not only being on the ground, but of leading men in battle in an environment, an insurgent war, where you've got different groups of people, different sects, the Sunni and the Shia in Iraq, who are fighting a bloody battle that we're in the middle of, but who we can't engage with on their level. You know, these are people who are fighting a very, very dirty and ugly war against one another and against us if they get their hands on us. As Americans, going into a war like that, you know, we've got a different mentality. We try to avoid behaving in ways that dishonor us. And it's something that Jocko takes very seriously. And he had to lead men into combat under those conditions. So we're going to talk about that. It was 2006, April of 2006, when you led your men into Ramadi to begin with, is that right?
Yes, yeah, that's what it was.
So shortly before that, a couple months before the Golden Dome of the Al-Askari Mosque was blown up by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi's people, this is an ancient Shia mosque, one of the most sacred places to Shia Islam.
Well, interestingly, Ramadi is primarily Sunni. In fact, it's almost all Sunni. And interestingly, the majority of the military forces in Iraq, especially the army, were Shia. And so you had to kind of diffuse that tension on a pretty regular basis to make sure that there weren't, you know, reprisal killings. And there was definitely some level of mistrust between the Sunnis that lived there in the city and the Shia military. But it was absolutely clear that the Sunnis that lived in Ramadi, the local Sunnis that lived in Ramadi, much preferred the Shia army soldiers to the insurgents that were there, that were being run by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, by Zarqawi and the likes. And because what they were doing was just savagery. And, you know, everything that you hear about, they were skinning people alive. They were beheading whole families. They were torturing, raping, and murdering the local populace in to get them to support them as much as they could through pure terror. And so the local populace, even though they might not have been, you know, they're basically going with who's their worst enemy at the time. Their worst enemy at the time was, without question, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so the Shia army that was there to fight Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Sunnis were generally in support of what the army was doing there. So it was a little bit different than in areas like Sadr City, where the Shias in Sadr City were very active. There's an active fight going on against coalition forces. So, yeah, it's definitely a tricky situation.
Yeah. When you roll into a situation like that with American soldiers where both sides are engaged in just a hurricane of atrocities across the country, and where the people who are there, they might be looking to you for safety, or I guess that's a question I would have. They probably, under the circumstances, were the people in the city. I mean, they probably were looking to you to protect them.
Absolutely. And just before we showed up, just to kind of paint this as clear as I can, and I forget the exact numbers, and I apologize for that, but just before we showed up, the insurgents murdered, it was something like 7, 8, 9, 10 of the leading tribal sheikhs in the area. And the tribal sheikhs that survived that left. They left. And so that just put the whole city, you know, under such a grip of fear of the insurgents that they just basically surrendered as much as you can surrender, which means, hey, if you want to come and stay at my house and you want to sit in my backyard and launch mortars at the coalition forces, we're not going to say anything to you because we want to live. We don't want to get killed. And that's what you end up with. You end up with passive support. And that's what the locals were doing. They were passively supporting the insurgents only because they didn't want to have their heads cut off. And so as we, and this was a brilliant strategy that was spearheaded by the 1-1 AD, the Ready 1st Brigade of the 1st Armored Division, run by a guy named Colonel Sean McFarland, who ended up being a general, and he's a brilliant guy and a great leader. But, you know, his attitude, which he actually got from H.R. McMaster, which he had employed up in Talifar, and 1-1 AD had actually gone into Talifar and gotten a turnover and understood what they had done up in Talifar. And the strategy was called Seize, Clear, Hold, and Build, which was go into these enemy-controlled territories, these enemy-controlled neighborhoods, and stay there. And so that's what the strategy was. And that was a lot different than the strategy that had been being used up until this point, not just in Ramadi, but in all of Iraq.
Is that a strategy that it almost seems like looking at reading about Ramadi from the outside as somebody who's never been in combat, it almost seems like the goal was to go in there and establish your dominance over the city, almost to show the people of the city that you don't have to be afraid of these people because they're afraid of us. And we have freedom in this city. We can take our Humvees and patrol these streets, and they're not going to come out and fight us because they're afraid of us, and so you don't have to fear them. It almost seems like that was the goal there.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word dominance because we weren't trying to dominate the local populace.
Right.
We were trying to provide security for the local populace,
sure.
And obviously that's a big difference, because when you start having an attitude of we're going to dominate the local populace, that's just a small step in the wrong direction. Right? That's
sure.
a small step in
sure,
the wrong direction.
Sure, sure.
Whereas saying, hey, we're here to protect and secure and stabilize the local populace, that is what we were doing.
Yeah, I think it took us maybe a little bit longer than we wish it would have to recognize that before you can do anything counterinsurgency, you have to provide security to the people.
Right? 100%.
If you're not leaving them a choice, then they're going to provide that passive support, right?
And I think that's one of the issues that shows up with the kind of episodes we did, you know, both the story of Sun Creek and the story of Milai. You have a situation in which suddenly some guys begin to look everybody on the quote-unquote other side as belonging to the same field. Why? Because they are all Cheyenne, or they are all Vietnamese. They are all, there's no sense that they are not all in the same boat. Some people are your allies. Some people are your enemies. Some people are exactly what you are saying, stuck in between, where I kind of have to cooperate with your enemies, not because I want to, but because I really have no other choice. And you cannot treat all of them the same way. And so I think the dilemma that you are facing, this idea of having to figure out, okay, there are people that we're here to protect. Those are not the people we're going after. There are other people that we need to take care of. That seems to be one of the things that was very much missing, you know, that nuance, that ability to look at people who may look the same way, but they are not the same people, to look at them with different eyes. That seemed to be really what was missing in some of the stories that we treated, where the guys who did what they did is because to them is like, an Indian is an Indian, a Vietnamese is a Vietnamese, whatever. It's all the same. Doesn't really matter. And I think it's like, how do you see what leads to that point on one side and vice versa? What is that you guys were doing to make sure that it doesn't go to that point where your guys would not make that switch to that frame of mind and keep their priorities very clear in terms of differentiating in terms of who they are facing?
And real quick, can I just add a supplement to that question? Because that's kind of what I wanted to ask as well is, how do you train your men and lead your men in such a way that they can pull the trigger when they have to? And when civilians get killed on, you know, accidentally, that doesn't destroy them emotionally, right? There's got to be some kind of separation there without having them fully enter over into that mindset that Daniele's talking about, where you're just dehumanizing the enemy altogether. When you have to lead your men in a situation like that, like how did you deal with that?
Yeah. Well, this is leadership.
Yeah.
This is leadership, and this is leadership in war. And this is, you know, this question that you're asking is one of the largest possible questions you could ask about combat leadership. And, you know, I appreciate that you guys keep referring to me, but I had 35 or 40 SEALs there, depending on the time. And there was 5,600 soldiers and Marines that were there, that were discriminating targets every single day, and that had outstanding leadership, that were making sure that guys with less training than my guys, guys that were younger than my guys, guys that had a tougher job than my guys in many cases, would still discriminate targets and make sure that they were engaging enemy personnel and not civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm certainly not saying that civilians didn't get killed, because civilians got killed, and it's an awful thing. And it's one of the things I talk about all the time. If you go to war and you're not comfortable with the fact that you're going to kill innocent people, then you probably don't have the will to go to war. And maybe what you're going to war for doesn't meet the threshold of what warrants a war.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what the conclusion you come to, that's fine. You know, let's hope you come to it before you're on the ground and blood has been spilled. But there's so many little things that we'd cover to talk about. I mean, just even the distinction that I just made between, like, hey, we're going in there to dominate. That's a little step. It's one little step. And using that word and then following it up. And we talked a little bit about this. And Daryl, you know, I was listening to your podcast about the Mealeye Massacre, and I did one about it as well. And one of the things that I talked about in pretty great depth, because for me, I had incredible correlation between what happened in Mealeye and what I sometimes saw happen overseas, and that was with the intelligence that you're receiving. And you could see, and I pointed it out in my podcast, and I don't remember like all the exact verbiage, but, you know, at the senior levels of intelligence, the intelligence report was that Pinkville, or the area of Pinkville, or Mealeye, whatever you want to call it, Mealeye 4, that area, the initial intelligence was, you know, suspected Vietnamese suspected Viet Cong area could be possible, you know, Viet Cong. And then it went down one level in the chain of command. And the next people that briefed it was, you know, just a little bit stronger. You know, it was, you know, Viet Cong area, Viet Cong controlled area. And then it went down one more level and it was Viet Cong headquarters area. And then it got down to, this is all Viet Cong. And then they threw in the fact that, you know, the people going to the market, right? It's market day.
Mm.
You know, that started off as, hey, some people will be at the market on this day. And by the time it got to the guys on the ground, it was everyone that's good is going to be at the market. Everyone that's still in the village is going to be bad. They're going to be VC. And Well, you know what to do with VC.
Yeah.
What he says is really interesting in terms of just human communication. How in that case, before you even go about Americans and Vietnamese, you even discuss war or lead, just the basics of human communication, how sometime starting 1 degree off, before you know it, if you keep it long enough, that 1 degree off took you so far off course from the reality they are trying to describe that the words which... It's kind of like playing telephone, you know, when you whisper something in the other person's ear. It doesn't sound that different from what you just heard, but you just tweak it just a tiny bit. By the time you're down 20 people, the message has no similarity whatsoever to the original one. And it seems like that has, I think we do it all the time in daily life, but nobody dies as a result of it. Whereas in that kind of scenario, people do die. The consequences are so much more dramatic as a result of that.
And what's interesting is, and Daryl, you kind of brought up in your podcast, and you did as well, mm-hmm. Daniele, is how does this happen, mm-hmm. right? How does this happen? Because if you take a normal human being and you drop them into the middle of that thing, they look around and they go, what the hell's happening? Mm-hmm. Which is actually what happened when Hugh Thompson came in his helicopter. He dropped into this situation and said, what the hell's going on here? This is totally wrong. But as you're getting there, if you're not on that mm-hmm. trip, if you're not on that train as it's going off the rails, you don't recognize it. And that's why one thing I talk about all the time from a leadership perspective is the ability to detach from all the chaos and all the mayhem that's happening. Because if you don't have the ability to detach from that chaos, you're in it. And if you're in the chaos as a leader, you don't see the mayhem that's happening. And so it's so important for a leader in the business world, but certainly in the military, to be able, or in any leadership position, to be able to step back and observe what's actually happening from a detached perspective. Because otherwise, you're in the storm, and that is not a good place to be as a leader.
You've got to have rules for how you're going to behave while you're going into it. Because if you just, you know, if you're going to react to everything on the ground once you arrive, I mean, it's always more expedient to just shoot them. You know, at the time, it's always easier and safer probably to just do the easy thing and be violent or whatever. So you have to have rules going into it.
One thing that I want, because the point he brings up is super interesting, but I think essentially what you're saying is that the person in a position of leadership needs to be a Zen master. You know, they need to be in the middle of emotions that clearly are affecting everyone around them, and they are getting bombarded with those emotions. They need to be completely detached from this stuff. It makes perfect sense. How do you do it? Because it's a hell of a lot easier said than done, clearly. And how do people even train to get to that place?
So, well, for one thing, when I was running the training for the West Coast SEAL teams, I would fire up that training to a point that there was total temptation for the leaders to get wrapped into the scenarios that I was developing for mm-hmm. them. There'd be total mayhem. And if they let it happen, they would get wrapped up in these horrible scenarios mentally, emotionally. Yep. Yep. They'd be mad. They'd be mad at me because I was the guy that was running the training. They'd be mad at the opposing force role players. They'd be mad at their guys. They'd start yelling and screaming. They'd make bad decisions. And I wanted them to get there. Because I wanted them to see what happens when you get wrapped up in this stuff emotionally. So, and then what I would do is teach them that they have certain, what I would call red flags, certain signals mm-hmm. that they need to learn how to pick up.
Yeah.
If you feel yourself start raising your voice, well, then that probably indicates that you might be getting emotional. If you're breathing heavy, if your fists are clenched, there's all these things that you start to recognize. And once you can recognize them and you say, oh, okay, I'm starting to get emotional right now, need to step back. Now, interestingly, what I would often do and an easy methodology for training these guys was, first of all, stop looking down the sights of your weapon. Like you're not allowed to. And we'd give a leader a stick if we had to and take their gun away so that they weren't going to be shooting. They weren't going to be wrapped up in that tactical situation mm-hmm. and literally put that weapon at high port and step back away from the firing line. Mm-hmm. You know, Callie is with his M16 gunning people down. He's completely wrapped up in what's happening. Medina's yelling and screaming. I mean, I talk about this with police forces as well. If you want to hear people, go listen to some of the bad shootings that you hear. Mm-hmm. And police have a incredibly hard job. They need way more training. But go listen to some of those shootings that take place and listen to the pitch and the tone of the officer. And what are they doing? They're saying, get down. They're completely emotional.
Right.
And that emotion is going to drive bad decision making. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn how to detach. The way you do it is, and the way I would initially teach guys to do it, is by physically putting their weapon at high port, stepping back away from the actual firing line, and look, moving their head around and looking around. You know, so the story I wrote about in Extreme Ownership is, you know, I had the Delta Platoon commander, who's a great guy, smart guy, you know, Ivy League, Naval Academy, and just a brilliant guy, great guy. And we were doing some training, and it was in Humvees, and we were doing immediate action drills in Humvees. So you're out in the desert, and your targets pop up, and you engage the targets. It's like being mini tank commanders, and you've mm-hmm. got five vehicles, and you've got to maneuver them on the battlefield while they provide cover fire for each other. And it's a little bit chaotic. There's big machine gun shooting. And when I was going with him, and I was sitting behind him observing him do this, and every time the shooting would start, he would kind of lock up, right? He'd kind of like lock up. There's so much happening that he wasn't processing it quick enough. And so I took a Sharpie magic marker and I wrote down on the window in front of his face. I wrote, okay, here's what I want you to do. When the shooting starts, I want you to do this. One, relax. Two, look around. Three, make a call. And at that time, I hadn't thought through this stuff as much as I have now because I've been doing it for much longer. But what I was telling him to do was, you know, detach from what's happening. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is you relax, you look around, and then you get on the radio and you make a call. And, you know, the next run I watched him and I was sitting behind him and I'm looking over his shoulder. And once the shooting starts, you can't hear anything. So I'm just watching him and I see him. The shooting starts and I see him look at the window and I see him take a deep breath and exhale. And I was like, okay, he just relaxed. And I see his head start to turn and I realize, okay, now he's looking around. And he, that those two simple items were enough to make him detach from all that chaos, actually assess what is happening, and then make a good decision. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of the most important things that you can train a leader to do.
Sounds like coaching a jiu-jitsu white belt. First thing you tell them, they're on the ground getting beat on, and they kind of, for the first thing you tell them, breathe.
Yeah.
Just breathe.
Yeah.
Relax. Until you can do that, then nothing's going to work.
Yeah. It's one of those things, too. People talk about, like, breathing exercises. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I would instinctively do, and it's another thing that I would train my guys to do, was, like, you don't panic on the radio. You don't yell on the radio. You don't scream on the radio. You, no matter what's going on, when you get on the radio, you say, you know, Bruiser 1-6, this is Bruiser, over. I mean, that's what you do. And in order to do that, you have to relax. You so it forces you, if you're not going to sound panicked on the radio, which if you sound panicked on the radio and your team hears it, guess what? You're going to have panic going on. So you have to, it's another method to detach. So when you hear your voice getting excited, when you read about Lieutenant Callie yelling and you hear about Medina yelling, that you know, Callie started yelling likely because Medina was yelling at him. And now that's what happens. We're just sending that panic through the chain of command, and it's a horrible thing.
I think what's fascinating about it is that the parallels, even to the scenario you're describing, is something that 99% of the people listening, 99% of the human beings will never have to deal with, because they're never going to be in combat with bullets flying all around them and all of that. And yet, it's easy to forget that the same dynamics are at play in most people's lives in ways that they may be able to recognize in with less extreme consequences. But like when you're a parent and you have your kids going wild and suddenly you find yourself, you know, raising your voice and starting to yell at them. And not the, because I mean, there's a time and a place. Sometimes the right thing to do is to kind of cool them on their stuff in harsh ways. But there's a difference between raising your voice with an intent and raising your voice because you're losing it and you're getting overly emotional and you're getting angry. And kids realize it and they will hear you. they will see how you are losing your stuff. They will see how you are less of a credible presence in their life, that they not can count on you that way because you are wrapped in your own emotions. And, you know, they press a little button and you go off. Sometimes they'll press that button because they enjoy seeing you go off. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll press that. But, you know, the point is you're not a good leader as a parent at that point.
And it's the same thing. I mean, my company now, we work with businesses all over the world, and it's the same exact thing. And I teach the same exact thing. If you're starting to get mad at your employee, you're starting to get mad at your subordinates, if you're starting to get mad at your boss, what should you be doing as a good leader? You should be detaching, taking a step back. I've told people, hey, if you start feeling that way, you stand up from the meeting table. Just you know, no one's going to say, hey, what are you doing? You just, you know, stand up, stretch out, step back away. People are having a heated argument and you start getting involved in it. Instead of getting involved in it, take a step back. By the way, when you do that, you look like a tactical genius because everyone else is starting to lose their temper. Yep. They're starting to say things that they shouldn't say. And you're the one that's listening. I just covered a book and just like a little thing is if you're talking, I'm going to let you talk. Because if I let you talk, I know twice as much as you. I know everything that you know, and I know everything that I know. So I'm going to win that tactical situation.
I want to come back to what you were just saying, Daniele, about leadership as a parent. Yeah. It ties into something he was talking about a few minutes ago with like a police officer who's panicking. We were mentioning this on the car right over here about police shootings. Like more often than not, what you see is that they're the result of incompetence. They're the result of a socially inept cop who can't manage the situation. And it's not an easy situation to manage. You've got a potentially dangerous person. You don't know them. And maybe they're lightly resisting you just verbally. And you've got to take control of that situation. Well, unless you're an exceptionally competent and confident person, maybe the only tool you have to bring that person under control is your baton or whatever it is. And you get the impression in Vietnam, especially once you get up to 68, 69, where, you know, they're starting to just throw junior officers in right out of, you know, ROTC and just throwing them into combat. And you hear stories about, you know, officers getting fragged. You start to hear stories about,
you know, Cali washed out OCS three times,
right? And you get these people now into a situation where you have a military unit that recognizes their incompetent leadership and they're scared. They feel incompetent themselves as a unit, and you get them into a place where and maybe this is something that you can contrast really well because you led primarily SEALs and Marines, right?
Well, SEALs.
Okay, just SEALs. You worked a lot with Marines.
We worked a lot with Marines and Army soldiers as well.
Okay, yeah. And
actually, mostly there was one battalion of Marines inside Ramadi.
Okay.
The 3-8 Marines. Awesome.
When you're dealing with the American military today, and I know, I mean, this is something that gets lost on a lot of people, is that as highly trained and motivated and all those things as our special forces are, you know, they're very specialized. You guys are, you know, trained for very, very specific, intense missions and stuff. But you go pull an average Ranger or Marine or something or infantryman, you put them in combat with good leadership. And that is an unbelievably effective soldier. I mean, American soldiers today are all volunteer force. These are incredibly well-trained and motivated people if they have the proper leadership. When you get back into a situation like that with Vietnam where you get a whole unit in that situation that cop's in, where they're in maybe a village, they don't exactly know how to handle this situation without resorting to lethal force, and they start to feel threatened and everything runs off the rails. You know, it's unrealistic to expect, just like, you know, you're a happily married man and you don't want to cheat on your wife, then when you're off on a business trip, after you've had a few drinks with the coworker that's on travel with you, it seems innocuous. Maybe it's totally innocent at the time. Don't go upstairs to the hotel to watch a movie, because if you get to that point, you're just putting yourself in a terrible position, right? And in that military context, the idea that all of the built-up momentum behind something like My Lai, the idea that you're going to get right up to that moment on March 16th, 1968, where the only thing that's stopping it from happening is a few pounds of trigger pull. That's the last bit of, you know, that's your last opportunity to avert this catastrophe, is just that few pounds of trigger pull. Good luck with that. You know, that's something that you can't let it get to that point. And that was something that, and then I'll let you guys take it over, but I wanted to talk about something that it was fascinating to me that you picked up on. As soon as I said the word "establish dominance" on the streets of Ramadi, you reacted against that. And you're right. That's incredibly important. And it ties into what you were just talking about you would make people either back away from the situation or stop looking down the sights of their gun. Because when you're looking at a person down the sights of your gun, it's your framing of the situation. And you haven't put down their gun, and now it's just a person. It's not a target. It's not anything like that. If you've got a bunch of people going into Ramadi and they're thinking in terms of our job is to go establish dominance on the streets of this city, well, you're framing that in a way that under the right circumstances could lead to trouble.
Yeah.
And so framing, it seems like, is what you're talking about.
And I also want to make it perfectly clear that if the soldiers, Marines, SEALs that we work with in the Battle of Ramadi, if they didn't dominate the street as we moved down it, we'd be killed. So there is, the job is even harder than I made it out to be, because I wouldn't want to use the word dominate the city of Ramadi, but you're damn right, we're going to dominate the space that we go into, and we're going to do that by being very, very aggressive. And so there is this fine line. And by the way, you'd go into you'd kick a door in Ramadi, and there's gunfire in the street that you're on. You'd kick in a door, and there would be a mom and a dad and a couple kids, and there'd be a normal household with green grass and a soccer balls. And that would happen. That's what the city was filled with. And so the fact that these guys, were able to flip that switch over and over and over again was amazing. And it's a testament to the military forces that we have and to the leadership. I want to give equal credit to both, but to your point about, hey, Milai, these were draftees. There was hundreds of thousands
of
draftees that went over there and did an incredible job.
Sure.
They were well led, that stood up when the wrong things were happening. So this was a horrible scenario.
Daniele, let's follow up on that then. I mean, that's what's the difference? Like, what happens?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get all the psychopaths in the army and round them up into one unit, right? By all accounts, the guys at Milai they were the type of people that when the folks back in Kansas heard about what happened, they couldn't believe that little Johnny would ever do anything like that.
And same thing at Sand Creek.
Right.
Same thing.
And so, because you're right, we were talking about this on the way too. Something today, it is we have something like Abu Ghraib happens. It's a terrible situation. A lot of bad things went on there. The idea, though, that an entire company of American soldiers would go into an Iraqi village and wipe out 500 innocent people, that is inconceivable today. In the sense that so many things would have to go wrong and break down and degrade and degenerate in the American military for that to have happened, that it seems like a completely different moral universe. And
well, you look at what the chain of events that led to Milai. It was those. And if any of those chain of events, anywhere along that chain of events could have broken that whole chain. Lieutenant Callie could have gotten killed in the minefield. And now you could have had someone else came in that was a better leader and didn't have a Napoleon complex and was able to stand up morally to other people. There's so many things that could have changed on that, that could have changed that whole scenario. The most powerful one being a different leader. Same thing at Sand Creek. Different leader, that actually never would have happened.
Right.
Absolutely. Never would have happened.
Yeah, and in fact, you do see that. You see all the guys under Silas Sol, like unanimously, they all agree with him, whereas all the guys with Chivington, it's like clearly there's a leadership element where the average guy in those units is heavily influenced by who's setting an example for them. And that is one of the things that interests me about human nature, that one of the things, because we're discussing, like, does that mean that human being, one of the things you hear a lot is, are human beings just evil by nature? And it's like, no, they're not evil. The majority of people are not. There are, of course, the exceptions. There is that whatever small percentage, but the majority of human beings are not evil. The problem is that the majority of human beings are extremely easily influenced. Like, their moral compass can range in so many different directions that under right leadership, they will be awesome human beings. Under wrong leadership, it's not that hard for them to start sliding down a really dark direction. So to me, it kind of is a matter of weakness more than evil. You know, it's not that these guys are complete psychopath where, you know, you have dinner with them and they are nice people and they help the old lady cross the street. And yet the degree, while they may have good intentions don't go too far without crazy discipline, strong willpower, a lot of the qualities that allow you to keep those good intentions real under heavy emotional pressure, where it doesn't all fly out the window and it's like, I don't know what happened, I just lost my mind, or hey, they told me that this was the thing to do and so I just followed orders. You know, where you have that integrity to stay present in a crazy situation, you're asking human beings to be kind of extraordinary in those circumstances, because the ordinary human being may go down a bad path. So the antidote in some way seemed to be to make yourself extraordinary, to be able to withstand that kind of situation. And that's where a great leader makes a huge difference, because so many people will be like flags in the wind. You know, if the wind is tilting one way, they will go with it. If the wind is tilting heavily the other way, they'll also go that route. And so that what interests me is, because while a few humans will always choose a pretty messed up evil side, a bunch of humans can go either way. What is that shape, the kind of human beings that will be able to be a great leader, or even just for themselves, even if they have nobody under them, just they will make choices that in an ideal scenario, most human beings would want to make. What does separate the guy who, you know, is sitting there on the couch saying, oh, I would be that guy, and the guy who actually is that guy?
I think one of the difficulties with that is, Jocko, you and Jordan Peterson talked about this in your podcast together. You were talking about the book Ordinary Men and how, you know, you've got a couple guys, a group of guys there who are being ordered to do something that's grotesque. And it's not simply a matter of, like, you know, that's a real good situation. If, let's say, you are a person of strong moral character, of just all the things that you would want him to be, you've got two conflicting moral systems here, because you have a duty and obligation to your fellow soldiers who are going to have to go do this one way or another unless you revolt completely. And then you're betraying your country, and there's all these other things that are brought into it that, you know, that are moral things. These are, you know, it's moral to not want to abandon your friends and your colleagues to have to go do the hard work that has to be done so that you can go nurture your self-righteous sense of personal morality, or at least that's the type of thinking that might go through a person's head. Like, what right do I have to put my own personal idea of what's right ahead of my obligation as a soldier, ahead of what my country is telling me to do, ahead of just being in there with all of my friends and fellow soldiers and leaving it to them? Like, that's a moral thing. That is something that you want people to feel, right? And I wonder sometimes how much of these situations are filled with people who, you know, maybe 90% of them, the vast majority that aren't those few evil ones, they're all kind of looking at each other like, maybe inside, they don't necessarily think this is right, or they don't want to be doing this, but they don't want to abandon their friends, and their friends are looking at them thinking the same thing, and you just have this vicious cycle, you know, that ends in one of these things.
Yeah, and part of the problem there is the human willingness to rationalize and make justifications for oneself. It's like, well, in that, because, you know, when you look at the principles that people hold, like what they believe their philosophy of life is and the way they behave, even in much more ordinary circumstances, I mean, you made the example of the cheating husband, right? How many people seriously believe that monogamy is the right thing and you don't cheat on your spouse? There will be lots and lots and lots of people who say, yeah, of course I believe in it. How many people actually live up to it? And it's like, come on, man, that's not, nobody's shooting at you. Nobody, there are no, it's a much more mellow situation, and people, in many cases, can't live up to their ideals in very ordinary circumstances, let alone when you start pressing the buttons and when the circumstances are no longer ordinary, but it becomes real panic time and stress and all of that goes up. So to me, it's like you need to have almost a maniacal determination to have this code of conduct that you will hold up no matter what happens. Like, I use it as, it's a joke, but it's not a joke. Like, I use it for daily life as, like, to me, once, I have very few moral rules that are absolutes, but the ones that are, there are no exceptions. So for me, like, if you give your word to somebody,
There are no exceptions. It's like, don't give your word unless you are 110% sure you're going to keep it. Don't. I don't mind. You know, we can have a regular conversation and you don't give your word. But if you do give your word, to me, there is no, oh, sorry, I didn't think in that situation or there was that exception. To me, the only way you apologize is a samurai style. You know, you stick a knife in your belly and you slice back and forth. That's how you say sorry. There is no exception to that.
It's almost as if those rules serve as pole stars when you're in a situation that's as chaotic as something like combat, where you have to have a few rules that, I mean, maybe they're arbitrary, but you'll die for them.
Yep.
Because when you're in the midst of a situation that is completely outside the realm of your normal experience, they give you reference points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they structure the situation a little bit for you. So you're not just lost in chaos. There's some structure to it. And then you can evaluate the rest of the environment relative to those hard and fast rules that you've got. Because in the situation, you know, when you're in My Lai and you're one of the people who's kind of on the fence, but now people are shooting, that is not the time to have this argument with yourself.
No, like, that's not when you're going to figure it out, for sure.
Well, this might sound really obvious, and it is. It's a very simple, obvious answer to this really, really hard question of, you know, how do you prevent this thing from happening, or who's the kind of person that will stand up? And the answer is actually quite simple. It's training and education. Mm-hmm. It's training and education. And if people understand that these kind of things can happen and they get put in these pressure situations and they get trained and they get debriefed on mistakes that they made and they saw that they got emotional and you train them correctly, well, then you've got someone who gets into a My Lai situation and says to themselves, wait a second, we're not getting shot at right now. Cease fire. And that was the most incredible thing about that story is that's all it took was one leader to say, hey, stop killing people. And they literally stopped that moment. So training people and putting them in these situations and educating them so that they understand, so that they have pattern recognition, training them so that they can learn how to detach, training them so that they can control their emotions, training them that they can see when horrible things are unfolding before them, and then how that they can put a stop to them. That is what is important. And as you mentioned, Daryl, as the Vietnam War drove on, the training got less and less, and the officers were getting sent over quicker and quicker, and you're getting on the job training, and the person that you're getting on the job training from is a person that's only been doing it for 2.5 months longer than you. And that's how these things occur. So you have to invest in people that are going to be in these situations. And it's the same thing. Again, I tell this to businesses all the time. Have you done, you know, on a construction site, have you done a drill if you have a mass casualty? Do you know where you're going to call in casualty evacuation? Do you know where you're going to get what the air flight or life flight number is? Does anyone have the life flight number here? Because if someone gets hurt, you need to make that call. And do you know what station you're going to call? What helicopter you're going to call? Do you know where they're going to land? Why would you not run those things? And if those things unfold and you're not prepared for them, you're going to fall apart. And it's the same thing with these ethical and moral situations where if you don't understand what they are and you don't understand what can go wrong, you're going to have a bad day.
Mm-hmm. And I thought it was brilliant what you brought up a little bit ago when you said there are steps along the way that long before the crisis manifests itself, there's that ability to recognize the tiny little steps that are leading there. Now, when you look at that tiny thing, it looks tiny. It doesn't look like a big deal. That's no crisis. That's not a problem. But it's that first step that's taking you down that path. And it's a lot easier to stop it early than when crisis is on. And so in that sense, that does become a training. That does become a thing of like, how do you recognize the steps? How do you work on it? And, you know, you were saying things like even something as basic, like, hey, breathe 1 second. Take 1 second to breathe before you react. Then think how you want to react. It's the same thing that applies to everything. It applies to conversation when people you care about maybe are getting you angry. Do you really want to respond right away? Or maybe take 3 seconds to take a breath, then decide how you want to respond, you know? And I think like, to me, is weird, is as silly as that is, because, you know, clearly war and parenting are very far universes in so many ways. But to me, it has been one of the, well, depending on your kids, I guess.
I got four kids.
But, right.
Get some.
But I guess to me, it has been one of the most unforgiving mirrors that I ever had put in front of me. Was seeing how I react under extreme stress, when you haven't slept for 2 days, when somebody's throwing a fit that's completely unjustified, and suddenly it's like, yeah, you have all the good reasons to be mad, but really this is how you respond? This is how you react to a four-year-old kid who's just being a four-year-old kid, and you get all emotional and you start yelling. And suddenly, like, 10 seconds into me blowing up, I see myself from the outside, and I'm like, I'm everything that I despise in this moment. You know, that man right there that's responding that way has all the reasons, has all the, I can see why, doesn't matter. You still don't do it, you know. And rather than just being like, okay, let's whip myself, I'm a horrible human being, I discovered that, it's like, okay, what can I do not to get there next time?
You got real world training, right? Because now you recognize the situation and now you don't let it happen anymore.
Exactly.
You know, I was talking to you guys earlier. I hit it my first deployment to Iraq. We went and hit a target, and it sounds almost like, you know, like what you'd imagine in a movie. We'd get handed a map, and on the map it'd be a city block in Baghdad, and there'd be a red X on one of the buildings, and that's all I needed. Oh, you want me to go hit that red X? Cool, we'll go hit that red X. And one night we went and hit, you know, the building with the red X on it. And when we hit the target, it was, you know, like the most normal family you could ever imagine. And as we started talking to them, and we had our interpreter get in there and figure out, you know, hey, do you know who this person is? They're like, yeah, he lives two doors down. Oh, okay. And so then I went back and eventually said to myself a question that if I had more experience, I would have asked this question for me. I said, hey, I got a question. Who put that red X on that building and why?
Right.
And as I pulled the string on it, it, you know, it was one of those things where they had gotten some intel, which, you know, I won't talk about where it came from, but it was intel that, you know, put it in that general vicinity, and they like picked the center of the general vicinity. There's the center of the general vicinity. There we'll put the X, and no follow up. And so I always taught that as something, hey guys, make sure you know who's giving you this intelligence. And that's the case that happened to Milai, where the person on the, no one at the platoon level said, hey, hold on a second. Who's confirming that this is 100% VC in this village? You're telling me this is 100% VC in this village? That's what we're saying right now? Who's saying that? I want to talk to that person. And that's another thing I talk about all the time is you don't, as a leader, you don't want to be surrounded by yes men.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be surrounded by yes men. And, you know, we're talking about the horrors of Vietnam War, and I'm reading another book right now, and there's a platoon commander, and his guys are going, they're rotating between three locations, and two of the locations are not too bad. The other location is a nightmare. It's Vietnam War stereotypical. It's booby traps, snipers, and indirect fire. They never see the enemy. They just never see the enemy. And all they do is they go out there on patrol. They get blown up. They get shot. They get mortared. And they never see the enemy. And the guys are getting wounded or killed. And as you think about that, I would pray that if I was the company commander or the battalion commander, that platoon commander would come to me and say, hey, Jocko, this is stupid. Let me tell you how many people we've lost. Let me tell you how many other the platoons have lost. And let me tell you what we've gotten out of it. We've gotten nothing out of it. And we need to stop this, or we need to find a better way to do it. If you want to send us in there, let us set up a strong point. Let us set up a bunkered position. We'll stay and we'll observe. But us just walking around in there waiting to get blown up makes no sense whatsoever. Please, let's do something else. And as a leader, you have to have the open mind to say, okay, I thank you. I appreciate that feedback. What are your suggestions? You've been in the area of operations. How do you recommend we do it? And whenever I hear these stories of guys that get put in really terrible situations in the military, it sickens my heart, because what you need is a culture inside any organization, the military, yes, but any organization, of people to raise their hands and say, hey, wait a second, this is stupid. Hey, wait a second. Do I not see an American flag on that Indian reservation with a white peace flag underneath it? And wait, hold on, stop. Why? Wait, stop. And that takes moral courage. It takes training. Mm-hmm. And it takes a culture inside an organization to stop people and question what they're doing.
And it takes that certain level of detachment that you were talking
about. It absolutely takes detachment.
You know, it's like you were saying about like dealing with a four-year-old mm-hmm. or something. Like when you're in the middle of it, it seems normal. It seems like the way to behave. And it's only when you step back mm-hmm. and say, you know, one of the things about human beings, our great strength, I suppose, is that we're supremely adaptable creatures. I was talking to a psychologist one time who used to work for the State Department. And he worked in Africa for a while. And he was telling me some of the stuff that he would encounter, whole villages where every woman had been raped 10 times over the years, where kids in this village had watched their parents killed. Just horrifying stuff. And my question to him at the time, because he was a psychologist, was, I mean, how are these people not just completely blown out with PTSD and everything else? Like, how are they functional at all, given what we know about PTSD and how it does function under circumstances that are far less severe than that? And that's what he said. He said, you'd be surprised. Humans are very, very adaptable. And to them, this is their environment. And that can work the other way, too, though. You know, that can work in the direction of in the new Ken Burns Vietnam documentary, which is just, I don't know if you've watched it yet.
I haven't watched the whole thing yet, but I watched the first two episodes.
Okay. So one of the ones you're coming up on. The name of it is This Is What We Do. And it starts out talking about this guy, new recruit, and he shows up to this place. And like the first thing he sees when he gets to the base that he's at, it's not a massacre or anything like that, but it's just sort of a Vietnamese prisoner or a captive being led along by, you know, a corporal or something. And he's just being rough with him and kind of pushing him along and doing stuff that clearly is outside of regulations. And this new guy shows up and he's like, hey, like, are you supposed to be doing that or whatever it is? And the first thing he hears when he gets over there is, kid, this is Vietnam. This is what we do. And he said that the whole rest of the time that he was there, when he saw something he didn't like, when he was doing things that he wasn't sure about, he just repeated in his head, this is Vietnam. This is what we do. This is what we do. And after a while, he didn't have to repeat it anymore. After a while, that was his environment. And, you know, it reminds me, I used to have these recurring dreams. I probably shouldn't share this on the air, but I used to have these recurring dreams. I still have them every once in a while. The details and the setting differ, but it'll be something like the dream starts and I'm in like a helicopter, say, and I'm flying around like a city like L.A. or wherever. And I'm just shooting people like Grand Theft Auto. It's just like a video game. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm going through and I'm doing all this. Sometimes there's people down there I know, my friends and stuff. And it's just it seems just like I'm in a video game. And then the way the dream goes is at a certain point after a few minutes of this, all of a sudden it hits me what I'm doing. And I look around and it's almost as if I wake up in the dream and I'm like, oh, my God, like I'm killing all these people. What am I doing? But at the time, it was completely normal. It seemed exactly like this is just what I should be doing or anything like that. And that's something I think that is, well, it's why you told people stop looking down the barrel of your gun. You know, you got to step back and be able to get that distance so you can change your frame.
And again, with the proper training and the proper education, you will know as a leader that that behavior will escalate. That behavior will escalate. And if you allow it to happen, it will continue to get worse. And so it starts off, and I've read all kinds of books about Vietnam, especially about Vietnam, where it starts off with, hey, the villagers are, we kind of know them, everything's cool, give them lollipops. But then, you know, one of our guys dies, and then, well, we're not giving them lollipops. As a matter of fact, we're kicking the kids away. And it only escalates to there, and it escalates to murder, and it escalates, it can escalate. It doesn't automatically escalate, because all it takes is someone to step in and say, hey, no, that's across the line. Like, you know what? You want to slap a guy? I get it. But that's the line. One thing that we used to say, and I used to tell my guys, once the cuffs are on somebody, so once we get somebody zip tied, it's over. Like, you do what you got to do to get a guy under control. Once they're zip tied, it's done. And now they're getting taken care of. And you treat them firm but fair. That's it. And so those lines, you have to draw them, and you have to hold the line as a leader, because things start to escalate. You know, it's the thing that you were asking me about earlier about the Chechen war and the Russians against the Chechens, and they didn't hold the line with the little things. And when you lose that discipline, even on the smaller things, well, eventually, then you don't have the discipline on the bigger things. Can you go overboard with that? Yes, you can. I can hold the discipline so hard on the little things that no one listens to me on the big things. That's why leadership is hard, because there's a dichotomy there that you have to balance. You can't be freaked out because, you know, you didn't blouse your boots when you were supposed to. But at the same time, if I start to let too many things slide, well, it will escalate.
And it seems like maybe with things like that, a lot of people who are civilians, they laugh when they see in movies or you know, TV shows or something about how soldiers in combat are still expected to groom themselves. They're still expected to take care of themselves and comport themselves in a military way. And what I tell them a lot of the times is, and maybe you can confirm this because I don't really know what I'm talking about, but is that, you know, my feeling on why that stuff is so important is that you can't have, you can't have Iraq and the sectarian war and all the stuff, the storm that's going on around them. You can't have that become the environment to which they're adapting. The environment to which they need to be well adapted is the U.S. military. That's their environment. That's what they're focused on, following these rules and behaving in this way. And then when that's their environment, they can go into these places and do their jobs. If they get in there and they start reacting to what's going on around them, because, I mean, you can tell a guy.
He's talking about going native, right?
Yeah.
You can't go native.
You know,
yeah.
Once
That's apocalypse now, right?
You can
right.
tell a guy once the cuffs are on. But, you know, if I was talking to a family yesterday and this is the guy that just cut their heads off, well, I mean, you know, you can't put yourself in a situation, because it does make sense to beat the shit out of that guy. It does make sense to put a bullet in his head when the cuffs are on, like from a moral standpoint in certain ways. Like, you can justify that, you know? And so that's why you can't be reacting to whatever it is that's going on. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, and there's actually an interesting dichotomy there as well, because you need to follow the rules, right? Because if the three of us decided, hey, we're going to go on this village raid and we're all going to use our morals as our guide, well, we have three different scenarios. Mm-hmm. You just admitted that you'd be executing somebody that was already handcuffed. Who knows what you'd be doing?
Don't want to know.
You know, I don't even want to know, right? So we're all over the map, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you're saying you're not even going to, don't even want to handcuff anyone because you think that's too offensive, and I'm somewhere in the middle. Whatever the case may be, we're all over the map. So I would always tell the guys, look, you need to do what is legal. What's legal? But then the paradox of that is sometimes what you can get away with legally still isn't the right thing to do. And that's why there's a dichotomy between those two, between do I follow the rules exactly? Or, I mean, you know, look at Milai, look at Sand Creek. My boss told me to shoot this guy. Mm-hmm. Told me to shoot this 3-year-old baby. My boss told me to do that. Mm-hmm. Should I be following orders? Is there a threat that I don't know about? You know, these days, you know, I've heard a lot of stories now. The guys that took down Mosul, right? The enemy was sending surrendering children to come and surrender to coalition forces, and they would be strapped with IED vests, suicide vests. And over and over and over again, it was our U.S. military, you know, especially our explosive ordnance disposal folks, and that were going and disarming these bombs on these kids. But yeah, how do you feel after you see two or three of those little kids get killed, plus two or three EOD guys get killed, and now you're going to fight those guys and they want to surrender? That's a very challenging thing. Mm. And if you don't maintain discipline, it's a slippery slope.
And it's funny because we're saying two things at the same time, which sound contradictory, and yet that's life. That on one end, you need to have these super strict rules that you're not going to bend under any circumstances. And on the other end, the thing that you rightly point out to is the fact that real leadership is also the ability to think on your feet and no two situations are alike. So the rule-following approach, while it may save you from some of the worst abuses, is not always necessarily the right thing. And there is also the time when we always follow the rules, except when we don't, because that's the one time when it's correct. And that ability to make the right call at the right time, that's what make an extraordinary human being.
When we're just sort of in debates or popping off at the mouth today, we sort of take for granted that the whole I was just following orders question was settled at Nuremberg. It was not settled at all. That's an incredibly complicated question for just the reason you were describing. You know, somebody who worked at a Nazi death camp, you know, they didn't make 10,000 independent decisions to kill somebody. They made one decision that their own personal moral compass was going to get outsourced to the state and that they were going to do their duty and follow their orders. They made that decision once. And now once you've made that decision and you've outsourced your moral compass, which again, under most circumstances, that might be the thing that keeps you from doing the wrong thing. That might be the thing that keeps me from executing that, you know, Al-Qaeda guy. But when the institutions themselves start to get warped, or if you're in even if the institution is an individual unit or something, you know, I can't remember where I heard it, but there's some zoologist or somebody who pointed out to him that like he had asked why zebras have black and white stripes when the grass is gold colored and yellow and they don't blend into that at all. Clearly tigers can see that. And he pointed out to him that that camouflage isn't to blend into the environment. That camouflage is to blend in with each other. They blend with the herd. And so the tigers have a difficult time tracking down, like, and focusing on an individual. And they figured that out because they wanted to try to, you know, put ear clips on them or something to track these things around. But they noticed every time they put something identifiable on one of them, the tigers would kill it. And it was because now they had something to focus on. And so and that's, you know, I'm not making a literal evolutionary comparison here, but there's an interesting, like, just sort of analogy, which is this instinct to blend in with the herd. There's safety there. There's a sense of security there. And there's virtue in forfeiting a certain amount of your personal judgment to the group to which you have obligations. That's a good thing under most circumstances, you know, and at least in a lot of circumstances, you know, that's what duty is. That's what, you know, just fulfilling your obligations to your people or you know, your unit or something. Like, who are you, especially if you're an 18-year-old kid who just got out of high school and you're over there and you're in a situation where you've got, you know, like in My Lai, you've got officers, you've got, you know, not just your immediate officer, but it seems to be being reinforced by your captain above, you know, your company commander. At the time in My Lai, there was a major general in a helicopter observing buzzing around that place. And so, you know, you're in a situation where you say to yourself, like, who am I to say that what's going on here is wrong? It seems wrong to me because of what I learned from my mama or whatever. You know, what does that mean? Like, I've got a captain, I've got a lieutenant, I've got my sergeants, I've got this major general in the air, and, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this, you know, I just got here 4 months ago. This is Charlie Company's first major combat operation. They really hadn't made contact, direct combat with the enemy. And it's the first time any of them have seen combat for the most part. And I think it's, there's certainly a certain amount of weakness that's involved, like you were talking about. But I also think there's a certain amount of moral confusion that happens.
Of course.
And that's there can't be that kind of confusion. Like, that is where leadership has got to take over.
Well, I can add another layer of complexity to this. Okay, so first of all, I do think that Napoleon said, if you execute an order that you know is wrong, and when he was talking about it, he's not talking about something immoral. He's talking about, if I do something where a bunch of my men get killed because the general said to do it, and I do it, I'm culpable. So that's pretty clear that if your boss tells you to do something that you know is going to, in Napoleon's case, it was get a bunch of your guys killed, then you say no. And if you do it, you're culpable for what happens. You could say the same thing if I get told to do something that's morally or ethically wrong and I do it. Well, guess what? Then I'm responsible for that. What becomes a little bit complicated to me or adds another layer of complexity is this. If I'm going to Sand Creek and I'm with Shivington and he says, hey, we're going to go there and we're going to execute this and we're going to kill these guys. Mm-hmm. We're going to conduct a raid. And I don't believe in it. Okay. So I say, you know what? I don't believe in it. I don't think it's the right thing to do. I think that we've made enough peace with them. We've caused enough problems. That's their land. I'm not going. Okay. So now you don't go because you didn't believe in the mission. Well, now who's out there conducting the mission? Everyone that's going out there to conduct the mission is people that are compliant with what he's saying. Mm-hmm. So you would be morally a better person if you said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do this, because if I don't, I know it's going to be someone that's totally compliant mm-hmm. with Shivington. And I'd rather be there to at least spare some of the people, which we know people did. And so there's a little complexity. You know, I talk about this in the business world, too. People say, you know, my boss told me to do this, and I think it's a bad idea, and I don't think we should do it. Okay, so are you going to get put off the project? Are you going to get pulled to a different department right. where you no longer can take care? Because this is too hard on my people. I refuse to do this. Okay, that's fine. You refuse to do this. I'll put someone in there that won't refuse, and you no longer can protect your people, yep. and your people are in a worse situation.
Yep.
So, you know,
the whole organization is degraded.
The whole organization. So you raise your hand, you make your protest, but sometimes you've got to say, okay, I've made my protest, and I understand that you're still wanting me to do this, and even though I think it's the wrong thing to do, I'm going to proceed down the path, because I'd rather me be able to mitigate as much of this problem as I can than have somebody that's just going to do this to the fullest extent that you would want them to do.
Yep.
So there's another additional complexity there that it gets involved.
Absolutely, because sometimes, as you said, just denying, you're just making yourself feel better, but the reality is that plan is going to go ahead. You are the only thing that stand in the way of that plan going to the 100 percentile. You can bring it down to 50, you know. Mm-hmm. It's still going to feel ugly. You're still going to feel part of something you don't want to be part of. But the only thing you do by refusing is patting yourself on the back and say, am I not a moral guy? It's like, yeah, but no. Because, you know, it's like the thing is you can use that power in that situation for something that is better than if you just look at yourself in the mirror saying how great you are by not doing it. And in fact, that's what was pretty incredible about the Sun Creek story.
Yep.
Silas Soule, you know, he's told right before, if you don't want, stay home. You know, nobody's forcing you. Just stay home. Don't be part of it. And Soul and Kramer and some of those guys said, no, we want to be there. We want to be there to observe, to be able to make the choice on the spot. And it makes a huge difference right there.
My feeling on it, just sort of looking at it all from the outside, is that, and especially in a counterinsurgency war, that without strict military discipline and strong leadership, that abject savagery is gravity will take you there. That's where things will head on their own unless you are supremely focused on discipline and leadership and education and those kind of things. That you don't really have to ask the question, how can this kind of thing happen? The real question is, how does this not happen all the time, right? How is it that American soldiers in Iraq and you go into Iraq and they're seeing maybe husbands and fathers that they spoke to the previous day that they know are innocent and not part of the fighting, and they see his wife beheaded and him with a power drill hole in the side of his head. How are American soldiers not going and executing reprisal attacks against these people all the time? How is it not just completely getting out of hand? And like, that to me is by far the more interesting question. I don't have to ask myself, how is it that, you know, somebody went and shot up, you know, the house of the person who did something like that? That's an easy question to answer. And the much more interesting one is how it doesn't happen all the time. And it seems like it has to be institutional. It can't come down to like, institutional culture, right? Relating it to their sense of personal identity and social identity with the group, that this is not who we are. That if I do this, it's not going to win me any kudos from my teammates or anything like that. They're going to look at that as a betrayal because I'm bringing dishonor upon us because this is not what we're about. And they have to be able to look at it that way. And if they don't know that, by doing something like that, they're going to, they want to blend in with the group. They want to be accepted by the group. They want to be looked at as somebody that can be relied on. And that has to mean following the rules and doing the right thing.
Danielle, you pointed this out earlier. You said, well, this seems like it's just the communications aspect is so important, and that's 100% right. So as we all know, the strategy in the Vietnam War for America was to kill more of them than they did of us, and drop more bombs on them, and eventually they'll just break, just a war of attrition. And so the strategy was get rack up as many kill count, as high a kill count as you possibly can. So that's the messaging. Mm-hmm. That's the messaging. So when that's the messaging, that's the messaging.
Yeah.
In Iraq, they were very clear about, hey, we're here to... We're not an occupying force. We're here to liberate these people. We're here to secure the populace and make sure that they can have a free country. That's the messaging. So does that messaging always make it down to the front lines? No. That's why we do have incidents where horrible things happen. Absolutely. But it is about the messaging, and it is about everyone understanding why they're doing what they're doing, what their mission is, what is right and what is wrong. And you can be educated on that legally. Hey, you're not allowed to do this. You can do that, but you can't do this. And then the other point that you made, which is, well, you said you got to be able to manage people in a time of crisis as a leader, but more important, and you actually asked a really complicated question and then answered it yourself, and you did that like three times in that one sphere of conversation that you had with yourself.
It's this caffeine.
Is you said, you got to be able to manage people in these pressure situations. And then you added that, but what you really need is culture. And you're right, because you're not going to be there. The leader is not. I wasn't with all my elements on the battlefield all the time. They were out there all the time without me. They were the ones that had to understand what they could and what they couldn't do. They were the ones that had to make those hard decisions. They weren't calling. My snipers didn't call back to me and say, hey, Jocko, I see this with this guy. They didn't even ask their platoon commanders that. They didn't ask anyone. They knew what the rules of engagement were. They knew what our strategy was. They understood. And one of the things that I told them, speaking of rules of engagement, so our rules of engagement was, several page legalese document written by some lawyers in Washington, D.C. or wherever. And, I've got kids in my platoon that are 20, 21, 22 years old, high school graduate, and they came in the SEAL teams like I did, by the way. And so they're looking at a legal document like that that it's... Doesn't mean anything to them.
Sure.
My rules of engagement for them was very simple. Make sure the people you're killing are bad. You make sure the people you're killing are bad. And why? And then I explained to them why that was important. And the reason why that was important was because the day that some civilians brought a headless body that it had taken a 300 Win Mag round to the head and their head was gone, and they said, this was our imam, or this was our school teacher, or this was our neighborhood doctor, and one of your snipers killed them, and they would figure out it was us. First of all, our operations would get shut down. So selfishly, we don't want to get our operations shut down. But more important than the selfish reason, if that happened, we would leave all the soldiers and Marines that we were working with on a daily basis that we were providing Overwatch for, we'd leave them without the support that we had committed to give them, because we weren't allowed to operate anymore, because we weren't being discriminatory enough with our fire. So the culture is so important. People understanding why they're doing what they're doing is so important. And if you don't get that messaging, and to your point, Daniele, if you don't get the communication correct, then you're going to end up in a world of hurt.
And the point you just made, the make sure the people you kill are bad, is such a... Think about it. There are so few words, right? You say it in like very, very few words. And yet it's so central, because you look at not only Sun Creek or My Lai, but look at even like half of the... when the Nazis invade the Soviet Union, and then when the Red Army does the counter and they start invading Germany, both armies do horrible things to one another civilian. And the idea is, well, the Nazis did it to our people, so we did it to theirs. Well, that mom that you are shooting in the head, she had nothing to do with what happened to your people. She's not the Nazi soldier who did it. She's not the bad one. Just because she's from the same nation, are you kidding me? That doesn't make her the bad person. And I think that's part of the problem with group identity. That's why stereotypes are dangerous, because you start grouping individuals into this mental category you may have of like, those guys are bad. That individual
only share some physical characteristic with the other one. They share, maybe they are even related, but they are not the same person. You know, they haven't made the same choices. They haven't committed the same action. So the fact that you treat all the Cheyenne the same, or you decide you treat all the Vietnamese the same, or all the Germans the same, or all the Russians, that's where everything goes wrong, because you are not making sure that the person you are hurting is the bad one, is not the one. There's no revenge there. They are not the same people. And so, and yet it happens over and over again where people fall into this idea of group mentalities. Well, I couldn't catch that guy, but he's one of their group. It's like, no, man, there are individuals that are involved. There are not, there's no collective guilt of, it's kind of the same reason why, for example, terrorism strikes us as so awful in every possible way, because you're not going against the guy that you have a grievance against. You're going against the guy from the same nation. It's like, that has nothing to do with one another, you know, there.
I feel like sometimes group identity, it's one of those double-edged swords, right? Because on one hand, there's the side of it that we mentioned earlier. Maybe your loyalty to your group and not wanting to bring dishonor upon them, if that's the culture, is what keeps you from putting a bullet in the head of the guy you just cuffed, right?
Sure.
You might be able to appeal to... you know, you can say to people, hey, we're Americans, and this is not how we behave. And you're appealing to their group identity there, you know, and that.
No, but
it's
I get it.
It's a double-edged sword.
But
you know?
that is a case in which you're using group identities for as the good guys. And granted, yeah, it may not be that every single one from that country really fit that idea, but you're putting a nice ideal and you're encouraging people to live up to it. That's already different from, while it's similar in dynamics, to damned bad guys and plugging everyone into that group, where do you know that that person really fits that stereotype that you have of that group?
How did you make clear to your men when you said, you know, make sure the people you're killing are bad, that they understood what was meant by that?
It is, well, there's, first of all, there are specifics in the rules of engagement, and one of them is clear hostile intent. Hostile act or hostile intent, which means this person has to be doing something actively that's going to cause a negative impact. Now, you can tell which people are bad. You can tell when they're starting to do something that's a hostile act or hostile intent. You can tell. And these guys, you know, my guys would, they knew, they would err on the side of like, I'm going to make sure that this person is doing something bad. But, you know, we had some decent arguments about the rules of engagement. I had some decent arguments about the rules of engagement up the chain of command, because the rules of engagement were applying to all of Iraq. And Ramadi was not like the rest of Iraq at this time in 2006. And, you know, if you've got someone that is, for instance, observing a location with binoculars, right? If you're observing, if you're in Baghdad, and you're looking at a location with binoculars, you're gathering intelligence, which could be considered, which is not considered a hostile act. It's the intelligence gathering. You might suspect the person being bad, but there's no way to prove that. Mm-hmm. In Ramadi, if you saw somebody that was looking with binoculars at friendly forces, they weren't gathering intelligence. They were absolutely coordinating an attack. And that is a big difference, because that is a hostile act and it's damn sure hostile intent. And so, you know, those are the kind of things that I would discuss up the chain of command, and we would provide them the resources. You know, it's, I talk a lot about playing the game, right? Like, if my boss tells me to do something, I'm going to play the game. I'm going to try and do it. And occasionally I'll get the question of like, well, what if you get told to do something that you really don't want to do? What if you got told to do something that you were opposed to, right? What if you got the order to go to the My Lai massacre and you got the order? Well, yeah, I'd say no. And first of all, that doesn't happen. The closest example I have to that happening was, for me, in Ramadi, we had been told that we had to take a certain number of Iraqi soldiers with us on every operation we conducted, because we were trying to turn the war over to them. And so they needed to get out there and do operations. And they were telling us, they were putting this rule all over every American unit in Iraq. You needed to have an Iraqi face on every operation. So what did the Americans do? What did the American units do? What they did was they say, okay, yeah, we're going to take our platoon of 40 guys and we're going to take two Iraqis with us, and there's your Iraqi face. Well, that doesn't move the war forward. They were obeying the rules.
Sure.
So the senior leadership figured this out and said, no, you guys are playing games. Here's the new rule. For every, and I forget what the number was, they made a ratio. For every seven Americans that you have, or for every one American you have to have seven Iraqis, or there was some number, some ratio. And in Ramadi, some of the units of Iraqis that we were working with only had 18 guys or 17 guys. And so that would have meant me sending my guys in the field with two or three SEALs only. Which sending, if you're going to go into a bad area, and who are you going to send? Because you want to have a radioman, you want to have a medic, you want to have a guy that can call for fires, you want to have a leader, and you want to have a couple heavy weapons guys. That's six or seven guys right there minimum.
Right.
And so when the chain of command told me, hey, you got to do this ratio, I looked at the ratio and I said, hey, guys, in Ramadi, that's not a good idea, and here's why. I'm not going to send my guys in the field without a corpsman or without a radioman or without a JTAC or without a machine gunner. I'm not going to do that. And you know what they said? They said, that makes sense, Jocko. You proceed. Like, if you articulate yourself correctly, then you can get your point across. Now, had they said to me, hey, listen, no, you're only allowed to do this, well, then I would have objected further up the chain of command. And I would not have put my guys at risk to do something that didn't make sense.
Yeah, of course.
Not going to do it. And again, that's what I always encourage military people, but not just military people, business people. Well, if you're the CEO of a company and you've given some directive that you don't understand the full depth of the directive that you've given, and your front line, somebody in your front lines realizes that's going to have a hugely negative impact on your company, do you want them just to follow orders?
Right.
You absolutely don't want them to follow orders. You want them to raise their hand and say, hey, boss, this doesn't make sense.
And the thing you said about, you don't want to surround yourself with yes men, which makes perfect sense. Then again, it's one of the things where you really need to have work on yourself, because the reality is that most people have an ego. Most people don't like to be told, hey, boss, sorry, but that doesn't sound right. It's like, what do you mean? You know, there's that reaction. It's like stung in their pride, which, of course, that's where all bad decision making start going. But it's a very normal reaction. You know what I mean? It's like most people have to one degree or another an ego. And especially if, like, your guy maybe phrase it. Maybe they're right, right? They make a point where they are pointing to something in your plan that doesn't work. But they phrase it in a way that's kind of blunt. So A, you don't like being reproached. B, you don't like the tone. By that point, even though their content is perfectly correct, you're not hearing it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you have a bad, I don't like you. First you're criticizing me, and then you're going about it with that tone. The guy is just saying things plainly how they are. Maybe he doesn't have a bad tone.
Yeah.
He's just not cuddling you in, like, slowly, gently,
yes,
saying, hey, let's see it this way.
And you know what? A guy in that, because I get that kind of question all the time with all the companies we work with. Oh, I got this guy, and my boss has a big ego, and I can't correct him because he just gets offended. Well, first of all, when you, just like you said, if you've got a big ego and I tell you that your plan is wrong, I'm attacking a fortified position, and you're only going to bolster your position stronger.
Exactly.
And so don't attack that position.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, a simple technique that you can use is say, hey, boss, I'm really not sure why we're using this approach. Could you explain this to me? Because I want to make sure that I really understand what it is you want me to do. And it seems like if I do this right here, it's going to cause this reaction. And I know you don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
So could you just give me a hand in fully understanding what your plan is?
Yep.
And that way you're kind of massaging their ego a little bit, and it opens their mind. And that's all you have to do is open up their ears. That's the goal, is just to open their ears a little bit so that you can start to have a conversation with them, and so that they can, you know, going back to the whole topic of today, so that they can see you as a human being with an idea or an opinion that actually matters, as opposed to seeing you as someone that's attacking their ego. And that ego thing, I mean, if you think about the wars that have been, you know, we always talk about the wars that are caused by religion, but the wars that are caused by ego are also pretty severe. And a lot of these incidents that we talk about, these retaliatory incidences, well, who's going to be the first person to say, you attacked my tribe, and I'm going to let it slide? That's a tough person. That's a hard position to be in.
Yep.
You're seen as weak.
Yep.
You're seen as you know vulnerable. You're seen as someone that can be pushed around. So that's a very delicate game that you have to play, and that causes problems. And that ends up it's a game that's so hard to play. In fact, that most people, or many people across the span of time, have said, "No, I'm not going to say that. They did. They drew blood. We're going to draw more blood."
Yep.
And it goes to what you were saying a second ago, too. Your people have to know that you're going to ask those questions of your leadership and that you're doing that work, because they got to trust you. You know, that way, when Jocko comes to him and says, "Hey, guys, I know this is going to sound a little bit weird, but here's what we're doing, and here's who you're bringing with you, and this is what we're doing," they know that if you're telling them to do it, it's got to be done. That every discussion has been had, that every angle has been looked at, that you've run it up the chain of command and registered your objections if they're there. But they know that Jocko is not going to send us out to do something like this unless it simply has to be done.
And I get asked this question a lot. Well, what do I do if one of my subordinates has a question about the way I've planned something and I don't have a good answer? What do I do then? And I say, well, what you do then is you listen to them.
Yep.
You actually listen to what they're saying, because if I've told you to do something and you've then responded with some reason why we shouldn't do that thing, and I can't explain away your reason, then probably I'm wrong.
Yep.
And as a leader, this is another thing where our ego plays a role. As a leader, our ego says, well, if I admit that I'm wrong to the troops, they're going to they're going to think I don't know what I'm doing. The opposite is actually true. If I was in charge of you two and I presented you with a plan and you guys came back and said, "Hey, that plan's not smart," and I said, "Shut up and do it the way I told you," you don't respect me more. You respect me less.
Absolutely.
And if I came to you two with a plan and said, "Hey, guys, here's the way we're going to execute this," and you say, "Hey, that's not a good idea. We should do it a different way." And I say, "Okay, well, what do you recommend?" And we come together with a collaborative plan. You don't think less of me as a leader. As a matter of fact, you think more of me as a leader. You think that I'm a humble guy that will listen and take input. And by the way, bonus is you all now have real, true ownership of the plan, and we all feel good about it. And when you guys go in the field, you execute it to the utmost of your ability because it's something that you own.
It's amazing how everything you're saying is – it's as if you took – a list of all the traits of Lieutenant Calley at Mili and literally just said, do the opposite of all these things. He was a guy who couldn't take criticism from his men.
100%.
Who asserted, who pulled rank anytime anything like that happened. Who was a complete transparent yes man to his captain above him, who was just never ask any questions. I mean, just right down the line. And as a result, his men had no trust in him. So that when they got into a situation that was chaotic, they felt like they were standing out on the corner by themselves in a country they didn't understand with nobody looking out for them. I don't want to say this in a way that makes it sound like I'm trying to justify anything they did. Of course not. But you put men in a situation where they feel like they're in complete chaos and they happen to have automatic weapons in their hands. Well, if I find myself in a situation where I'm completely overwhelmed by chaos, that automatic weapon's probably going to start to look like the best tool I have for structuring my environment.
Yeah, there's and obviously this went way beyond that. Years ago, I forget how many years ago, there was a shooting in New York City. I think it was 38 rounds were fired at maybe a homeless person, an unarmed person. I forget the situation. But there's a lot of people that just couldn't believe that all these police officers shot at this unarmed individual. It's a freaking horrible situation. And again, I always will say this. Like, whenever I talk about bad police shootings, I've been on ride-alongs with cops. I've done hits with cops. It's a freaking hard job.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not a guy that, like, I've done that a couple times here and there, but go out on that beat every day and deal with those scumbags of the world every single day. And you're going to have, it's one of the hardest jobs in the world. That situation, people say, how the hell did that happen? Well, there's a lot of tension in a situation. The emotions are high. People are screaming. We're not trained well. Everyone is sitting there with their slack out of the trigger. And when that first bang happens, it's a chain reaction. That's one of the situations that, you know, I would see with my guys that was beautiful in Ramadi, was they wouldn't do that. If one of the snipers took a pointed shot at someone, they would take the pointed shot and the others would hold fire, check fire until, you know, the situation either evolved or de-escalated. But the Army was always quite impressed with the fact that we would take really surgical shots at bad guys and there wouldn't be, you know, massive amounts of collateral damage. Again, sometimes it's unavoidable, but...
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because I think that's one thing that gets really lost on a lot of people today, and I think there's a lot of propaganda that helps it get lost. You know, there's no question that there's been an evolution in our values and our relationship to these kind of things over the years. You go back to something like Sand Creek, 1864, there might not have been a whole lot of people shedding too many tears over what happened. You get up to My Lai, and, you know, there's some controversy and there's some, you know, there's a cover up, all those kind of things. But once it comes out and it's laid bare and the evidence is clear, things had changed from 1864. And that incident and a few, you know, other incidents that were going on that made it out, or a few pictures that came out, it turned people against the war. They decided that this is not worth putting our men in a situation where we're going to be doing things like this. This is not worth it. And you get up to today in the Iraq war, something like Abu Ghraib, which is an unacceptable situation. But we're talking about prisoner abuse that doesn't that wouldn't cause the people who were working that prison 5 years before that, the Iraqis who worked for Saddam, that wouldn't even, you know, they wouldn't even make it through their filter, right? So, I mean, what was going on there with the American soldiers? It was not okay, but it wasn't walking into a village and massacring 500 people. It wasn't, you know, brutal torture in the same way that we would think of what was going on before we took control of that prison. And yet, our response to that and the military's response to it once it came out was pretty dramatic. I mean, and it was quick. It didn't. There was not as much of a delay. As soon as it comes out, there's a clear shift that's going on there. If even primarily from the standpoint of it's a breach in discipline. That's not how you behave.
Yeah, and one of the things that I talk about with my guys is, because you got to frame this right. Because you know, you mentioned earlier that if you had dealt with this person that had cut the heads off of the 3-year-old girl yesterday, and now you had him cuffed and knew it was him. That guy deserves a bullet, right? Hey, I agree with you. That guy deserves a bullet. The problem is, well, number one, it's a breakdown in discipline. But to me, more important, and what I would tell my guys is, if we behave that way, we have a significant chance of strategically negatively impacting our war effort. So I get that you want to kill these bad guys. But more important than us killing these bad guys is us winning this war. And so if we run around doing dumb things, we're going to have a negative strategic impact. And that was actually always the biggest worry as a leader, is you don't want to have something happen where you drop a bomb on the wrong area, or, you know, and a bunch of civilians get killed, or, you know, you don't want to have that thing happen. That's a real – and the effort and lengths that American forces – go to prevent civilian casualties is incredible.
I don't think most people have any idea.
No, they don't.
How
they
it
don't.
Works.
And I think that's one of the cool things about creating a certain mythology that people want to live up to. The first time you say it, it may not be true. It may be a wishful thinking that you are those people and you are not quite there. But as people keep repeating it, and you run again and again with the fact that your behavior doesn't match your ideals, more and more people will keep working on trying to actually build that thing. They don't want to feel like hypocrites. They actually want to live up to that ideal. And that's one of the things where, while sometimes people get turned off by when you have this high-minded ideal and this very poor behavior, they're like, ah, look at that hypocrisy. They say these things and they don't mean it. Well, sometimes when you say it long enough, people actually do want to live up to it, and they do change their behavior.
Oh, yeah.
So while the theory may not match the practice when you start, if you keep at it long enough, the practice may try to inch closer to matching that theory.
Yeah, the ideals
matter a lot. And that's not a bad thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you can take it to a political context, right? When people can point back at the United States, say, before the 1960s and before the Civil War, and point to the Constitution and Declaration of Independence and these high-minded ideas, and people love to be the cynical one that says, oh, yeah, but slavery and
of course.
But this and but that. And yeah, totally true. But the conclusion to draw from that is not that the ideals don't matter or that they're just on paper. Mm-hmm. The fact that those ideals were there was what allowed the civil rights movement to eventually
Absolutely.
Come into being. That's what gave us the room. In fact, you could even say that the thing – we're talking about the same thing. That gap between ideal and reality, mm-hmm. one way to talk about that is hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that gap, that opening – that's the opening where people realize that and say there is a gap between yep. our professed ideals and it makes room for that kind of positive change, right? I mean, you can go back. Mm-hmm. The Mongols were never, ever going to give up slavery because their moral system didn't have room for that.
Yeah.
And so you could go up to them and say, well, how dare you enslave these people? And they're not going to get defensive. They're going to look at you like you're crazy because right. there's no room yep. for that. For that gap.
That idea doesn't even exist.
Yep. Right. And so the ideals matter. And when yep. when they're broken, again, I think that there's a motivation on the part of a lot of people who are more cynical than they should be, given the country that they're fortunate enough to live in. This is something that you get from going overseas to a lot of places. It's something certainly that I got from spending so much time in Africa and the Middle East for work is – boy, you come back after the first trip over to those places and you realize you want to kiss the ground when you get off that airplane and you want to go around and just hug everybody you see because you are so fortunate to live in a place where things that we absolutely take for granted over here are miracles. And, I think one of the things I didn't want to do when I was talking about me lying that episode, I stayed very focused on the incident itself, sort mm-hmm. of, because you don't want to be making excuses for something like that. You don't want to make it seem like you're trying to gloss over an atrocity. But you don't want to give fuel to that idea that like this speaks to like a larger problem in our society, because I just don't believe that.
Well, that's why it's a dance, right? Yeah. If you start pushing the button too much in the direction of making apologies for, well, after all, we are good guys and there are a few exceptions, but look, we stand for freedom and democracy. It's like, yeah, maybe, but let's not be so quick about sweeping under the rug all the bad stuff. Let's look at it. The guys who instead push on the button of, hey, look at all the bad stuff, that means that all these ideals are crap and it's not real and it's all hypocrisy, is like, whoa, slow down a second. Yeah, you get a couple of points where you're right, but you're also missing the boat. It's like, it's almost like, and that happens in most discussions, like in most situations, you rarely have somebody who is 100% wrong, is that they take a partial truth and they take it too far. And they lose perspective of the other side mm-hmm. of the equation.
Yeah, like people don't understand. Like American soldiers were killed and maimed in situations that absolutely could have been avoided mm-hmm. if we disregarded our rules of engagement and if we made – like we made conscious decisions to put ourselves at risk when we did not have to because we were trying to be sensitive to the environment and to the people that were there. And I don't think enough people recognize the historical anomaly that is. I mean that is just a – you can't for thousands of years of human history, that is just completely unthinkable. Sure. You couldn't imagine something like that. And the extent to which we go, I mean, Jocko has talked about this before on his show, the extent to which we go to try to make sure that the people, the targets that we're dealing with are targets. I think if more civilians had an idea of that, people would feel a lot different about what we do over there. It doesn't mean that when something happens like Abu Ghraib, they're not going to react against that, but they're going to react against it from a place of, hey, we're a good country. That shit is not going to fly. All right. That's not what you're not going to represent us that way. And that's fine. That's a healthy way to respond to something like mm-hmm. that. But, again, political situation or whatever else is going on, people have more of a knee-jerk reaction to those things that you're talking about.
And so. I think in that sense, it goes back to that Dan Carlin approach to things, right? That ability to look at things one way. And just when you're getting comfortable with that conclusions to say, yes, maybe that is the conclusion we take, but it's not that easy. There's also a 20% from the other side that's not really wrong, and you should include in that. And that keeps you thinking on your toes. You don't become dogmatic. You don't become thinking in purely black and white terms. You always have to have that nuanced approach, which... And that's the problem. That's the other paradox, is most people take nuance to mean weakness. Then you can't make up your mind. You are too wishy-washy. You are, it's not black, it's not white, it's somewhere in there. It's like, no, that's also a weakness, is the ability to look at things both ways and also make a decision. That's where, to me, it comes in as where it's valuable. And I think it's funny because so many of the things that Jock brings up are so about really... the kind of human being that you want to become, you know, about self-perfection, really, because that's what it boils down to, which is then what makes you a great leader, because there's no great leader without somebody who has worked on themselves a lot. And, you know, when you break down to the principles, nothing sounds like it's that hard, right? Mm. It's all like, okay, of course, yeah, that makes sense. Oh, that completely... And yet it's one of the things where, while the theory may not be that hard, the practice is unrelenting. You have to be at it every single day or it's so easy to sleep. There's a great line in the Tao Te Ching that I was mentioning to Daryl when we were driving down. There's this line that say, my way is very easy to understand and very easy to practice, but nobody understand it and nobody practice it. And I love it because, yeah, in theory, yes, it's not that bad. It's fairly straightforward. And yet there are so many steps along the way where it's easy to go the wrong path.
Yeah.
That is like, yeah, the theory is easy. The practice is you need to put in the work and there's no substitute.
Each of those steps matters so much too, because, you know, Jocko was talking about escalation in those situations. The book about the war in Chechnya you talked about, I think the line, I hadn't read the book until I heard your podcast on it. And it's one of those things that when you hear it, it's so obvious. But if you were to just step back from the context a little bit, it kind of seems ridiculous, which is that the savagery started when people stopped shaving, when soldiers stopped shaving. And I think part of the reason for something like that is the escalation is like a ratchet. Once you stop shaving, well, now you're a unit that doesn't shave anymore. Okay, whatever. Well, what that means is if you're a unit that lacks discipline, well, now your lack of discipline is not going to manifest as not shaving. You already don't shave. That's normal. That's totally normal. So now your lack of discipline is going to get to the next thing. Now I'm not cleaning my weapons properly. And then pretty soon you're a unit that doesn't shave and doesn't clean your weapons properly. And that doesn't even seem like a lack of discipline anymore. That just seems like daily life. And now your lack of discipline or whatever it is going to go up to the next spot. And it can happen with, you know, it can happen with just brutality and savagery and things like that as well, where now this kind of thing is just normal. So if I'm angry, and it's totally normal for us to be able to smack these prisoners in the face, but now I'm really pissed. Well, I'm not going to smack them in the face. I smack them in the face anyway. You know, so I'm going to show my anger now by stepping it up. And, man, well, okay, if that slides and the leadership doesn't step in, well, now that's normal. Yep. And we're, you know, we don't just smack soldiers. We punch and kick soldiers. That once that's the baseline, it ratchets up to that point. Well, it's going to escalate from there because, you know, that's kind of where it goes. And that's why catching those things right at the beginning and letting people know that, you know, all of these things matter. I mean, that's probably the life lesson of a lot of the stuff you even talk about is everything matters. It all matters.
Yeah. And it takes some time. Like I didn't realize this when I was a 20-year-old SEAL or a 25-year-old SEAL. You know, I kind of started getting the indications. And that's why, again, you know, I talk about training and leadership because that's what this stuff is. You know, putting somebody into a moral dilemma with no training is like putting someone onto the jiu-jitsu mat with no training. They're just going to get destroyed. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and they have no control over it. And, you know, you got to think about these things. You got to think deeply about these things so that you have some sort of an anchor that's grounded that won't get ripped out at the first person that says, hey, shoot that 3-year-old baby. You need to be grounded and have thought about these things in a deeper way. And you know, what you said about people swaying one way or the other, you're right. And people actually want to be led. Mm-hmm. And they want to be led even more so when there is a pressure situation going on, when there's something that you're not used to or that people aren't used to, some kind of stressor, some kind of stress or pressure, if you can step up and lead at that moment, people are looking for it. They're looking for a leader. And that was, I remember you were talking about one of the guys in Milai, the 6'3" guy, and he's a natural leader, right? He's a natural leader that people kind of followed. And what he started going sideways and started just getting completely savage and brutal, people just kind of, okay, you know, he's a guy, you know, like, okay, that guy's stepping up. And there was no one on the other end of the spectrum to say, hey, no, we're not doing that. Stop. And that's the biggest lesson from that situation, actually from both the situations.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talk about how can the leader be responsible if they're not there? You know, yes, the leader's responsible, whether they're there, the way they train the people, the way they educated, the way they communicated, the culture that they set with those people, they're responsible. And certainly these leaders were absolutely responsible in these scenarios.
I guess before we wrap, one last thing I want to ask you is, these days, you say you work a lot with businesses. You clearly are, you know, you're working primarily on the concept of leadership and how to teach people better tools to handle it. How do you go about it? Is it primarily like a business-oriented approach now with major businesses that are...
Yeah, we'll go in and do an assessment and figure out where the friction points are, figure out where they're having problems, and then we solve the problems that they're having through leadership. And that's every single problem in every single organization is a leadership problem. All of them. Mm-hmm. Whether it's your P&L's upside down, whether it's your processes aren't working correctly, whether you got the wrong people in the wrong positions, it doesn't matter. The problems are going to get solved through leadership and leadership alone. And that's why we're doing well, because if you've got a P&L that's upside down, you've got leaders that aren't paying attention to their expenditures and their income.
Right.
If you've got processes that aren't working, you've got leaders that are in charge of those processes that are allowing them to continue to exist without refinement. If you've got people that are in positions that shouldn't be in those positions, you've got leaders that are allowing them to be in those positions without either being coached and mentored and trained so that they can lead, or removed from those positions. Mm-hmm. And you can go right down the list with any problem that any organization is having. There's a leadership solution to that problem. And that's what we do.
It seems to me like it's definitely the thing I'm going to take away from the most and listen to you talk about this stuff. Is one of the things that struck me is I came in with a lot of questions in mind. I wanted to talk to you about, like, that I started out with, right? You got your guys, you're going into a horrible situation and there's these horrible things going on. How do you restrain your guys from going and retaliating in these terrible ways? And your response and the look on your face and everything to it, it actually like kind of threw me off a little bit. It wasn't what I was expecting, because your answer to that really was, dude, if I have gotten to the point where we're there in Iraq and there's a guy with handcuffs and I have to figure out how to restrain my guys from doing something, I failed a long time ago. Because you took it as almost like, you deal with it. That was taken care of. How do we stop them?
Yeah,
we stopped them in training. We stopped them in boot camp. We stopped them at BUDS. We stopped them in all the way up to here.
And I don't want to make that – I don't want to make light of that, because that is a hard situation. And – when you lose guys in a unit of 35 guys and you got guys that are wounded and killed, there is absolutely there is an absolute fire that you have to control, because we know who's doing it. We can find them. We can get out there and get after them. And so we do have to keep ourselves in check. We do. I mean, we had many conversations of, hey, remember why we're here. Remember who we represent. Remember that if we get out of line, we won't even be allowed to do what we do anymore. Oh, so don't take it the wrong way that in any unit, you lose people, you lose your friends, you lose your brothers. That is an emotional thing, and you're in an emotional situation already. And you have access, direct access, to unleash your emotions if you are allowed to. And the, you know, with the platoon commanders that work for me, with, I mean, those guys, you know, Leif, who wrote the book with me, I mean, he absolutely had to sit his guys down and explain to them, hey, let's remember why we're here. Let's remember that we could go to jail if we do the wrong thing. And nothing that we do here is worth any of you going to jail for any amount of time. So I didn't mean to make sure light of how hard that is and how difficult that can be. And it's not just for me, not just for the SEALs, but, you know, the Marines, sure, the soldiers that were there who are dealing with, like I said, they're dealing with younger kids and less training. And, you know, those, when you come in the SEAL teams, you came in because you wanted to go to combat. Like, every single SEAL wants to go to combat. They want to be there. I don't know if you've ever heard my retirement speech. It's on YouTube. But when, like, I made a list and said, hey, if you want to go over to the eastern part of Ramadi and live in a blown-out bunker and get into firefights every day, put your name on this list. And I walked out of the room. I came back 20 minutes later, and every single guy in the task unit had their name on the list. So we're dealing with guys that every single guy, that's what they want to do. Now, do they get tired? Do they get combat stress? They absolutely do. Do they get scared? Yes, they do. It's hard. But we have a guy that at least start from the position of, I want to do this. This is my profession. The Army, you know, you definitely end up with guys that are coming in the Army because they wanted to pay for college, or they wanted to get a job, or they wanted to get out of whatever hometown they're in. And that's how they ended up in the Army. Again, there's also a great number of soldiers that are just as eager for combat, and certainly a great number of Marines that are the same attitude. So each one of those people, you have your own challenges, and it is hard, and you do have to. And what goes back to what this whole thing has been about, as the leader, you can't be the one that's getting wrapped up in those emotions. You can't be the one I'll tell you what, your heart's going to be fucking broken when you lose guys. It's going to be broken, and you're going to want nothing more than to go out and rubble cities and salt the earth so everyone is dead and no one will ever live there again. But if you let that get a hold of you as the leader, your team and your men are going to be in hell. That's where they're going to end up. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the education, the training, the understanding. I mean, so many people contacted me after I did the Melai podcast that, thank you. They play that Melai podcast for leadership training inside multiple military organizations. It's awesome. I'm so happy that they do that, because when I came out with that podcast, I had tons of people that said I didn't know about that. People that were in leadership positions didn't know what the Melai massacre was. And it's one of the darkest stains on our history, but you have to talk about it. And you talked earlier about, hey, I didn't really want to go into too much of what led up to it because I didn't want to make excuses. Man, I went into detail of why it happened because I want everyone to understand all those little things. How when you cut those corners, how when you play the telephone game with your intelligence and you let people say things that you don't put them in check, and you let them use words that aren't correct, and you have people that don't have a culture to ask why we're doing this, and you set those situations up and you let bad leaders into in positions that they shouldn't be in. Cali failing out of OCS multiple times. Like, that's it. That's it. You let those things happen, and you're going to end up in hell. And as a leader, that's your job to stop it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good place to wrap it up, man. Melai didn't necessarily happen on March 16, 1968. It happened when Cali failed OCS. It happened when the intelligence failed to get passed down properly. It failed every time somebody was allowed to smack around a Vietnamese and they didn't get called on it. That's when it happened. You know, the actual acute incident was just the result of a long, long process. So
awesome.
That's great, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks for you guys for what you do. And you guys put out kick-ass podcasts, and I appreciate listening to them. And yeah, maybe, man, we'll get to do this again sometime.
Thank you as well. I mean, I can tell you from my own personal experience listening to your podcast, as well as a lot of guys I know of all ages, guys from high school all the way on up into their 50s. One guy that I know is a huge fan. You know, I don't want to It's just three of us, and it's getting a little sweaty in here already, so I won't get on my knees too much. But it's not an exaggeration to say that you're changing people's lives. So thank you. Keep it up.
I mean, appreciate it, man.
You've had a great effect on me personally, so thank you.
Thanks, Bobby. Thanks for listening. Thanks, guys.
It's a wrap. Big thank you to Mark Blanchett for sponsoring History on Fire on Patreon at the $50 level. The prize is to have your name horribly mispronounced with an Italian accent. If you guys want to check out my Patreon, that's always a sweet thing to do. But also, let's give thanks to the sweet folks at blueapron.com. As I mentioned in the intro, right before I started recording the intro and outro tonight, I shared with the amazing Savannah M a Blue Apron meal that she cooked. We had seared steak and mushroom sauce. I hope I pronounced seared steak right. Savannah just properly chastised me earlier because I was pronouncing it in some weird Italian way that had no semblance to the actual English words. On top of it, we had an awesome night of red wine, classic reggae, kisses, so good life. So thank you to Blue Apron for being part of this very happy night and for sponsoring this episode. So for you guys, Blue Apron is offering History on Fire listener $30 off your first order. So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/onfire. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. This episode of History on Fire is also brought to you by Cannaway. This is kind of an experiment for me. This is not a traditional sponsorship in any way, shape, or form. What I'm doing with these guys is that I'm really interested in their product, and I kind of partner with them, first because I really just want to try their products, and also I think that they can be something that helps people. So, what exactly do they make? They make some incredibly high quality CBD oil, and you know, there's no traces of THC, so there's no issue of being considered a derivative of the cannabis plant, of course, but there's no, it's not a drug, no, it doesn't contain THC. Yes, it's legal to use and possess in all 50 states and Europe. It's legal even for professional athletes, since they make sure that their products are completely THC-free. So even the World Anti-Doping Association has approved its product. In case you are not familiar with CBD oil, I suggest you Googling, because it's really interesting. The CBD affects the endocannabinoid system, which help regulate memory, appetite, mood, anxiety, blood sugar utilization, and in particular inflammation, which is a huge thing for health. So if you want to check out their products, please go to cannaway.com/2496006. That's again it's kanaway.com/2496006. If this was too long of a website, check it out in the episode notes at History on Fire podcast. Other people I'd like to thank, Onnit. I'm not going to tell you today much about the products that Onnit sells, even though I like them a lot. And if you do want to check them out, That's onnit.com/history. I rather tell you today about a book that Aubrey Marcos, the CEO of Onnit, has just published. It's called Own the Day, Own Your Life. Check it out on Amazon, see the product description, see if that's something that may interest you. Aubrey has been very good to me and my work all these years, and I'm really happy that he's getting to publish his first book. Also, people who have been very good to me, Chris O'Dell from Datsusara. Ever since I've been introduced to the company Datsusara, I've been using their products every single day for the last few years. I haven't found a single one I didn't enjoy. There's actually one thing I want to try. They are now selling this hemp protein powder. I haven't checked that out yet, but I will. So check them out at dsgear.com. Again, the letter D, the letter S, gear.com. I mentioned to you guys before the podcast How It Began, A History of the Modern World, produced and hosted by historian Brad Harris. Brad is supporting this particular episode of History on Fire, so big thank you to Brad. But also, the reason why I want to mention them is that it's a very different kind of historical podcast. You know, it's not the long form of the Dan Carlin or even what I do. It has a somewhat shorter form approach, but it's really fascinating because it takes some topics that are really like stuff that I probably have not thought about them, and yet he managed to reveal something pretty amazing about seemingly mundane things. So he did one about the technology that allows people today to have refrigerated food. And when you think about it, it's something that we use all the time. It's so normal. I mean, who even thinks about that? And yet it's one of those inventions that has completely changed human life in the last 100 years or so. So Brad is a master at doing stuff like that. So check it out at How It Began, A History of the Modern World. It's available, you know, everywhere you download podcasts, and also on his website, howitbegan.com. And last but not least, a couple of shout-outs to nevertapgear.com. They make excellent knee braces, which I use when anytime I train jiu-jitsu. And to revolutionspirits.com, who sent me some awesome bottles of gin, amaro, and a few of the other spirits they produce. So with that, thank you to all these folks. Now, next couple of episodes, we go back to the narrative format. I'm gonna tell you a crazy story which is pretty much unknown. I don't think I've read anything in it in the English language. I'm sure there may be something, but almost all my sources were Italian, so for once you'll hear me pronounce words I can actually pronounce. I'm super excited for the next couple of episodes because it's a really wild, incredible tale, and I can't wait to be telling you about it. So, having said all that, I just want to wish you guys an amazing day. And life is hard enough. Let's not make it any harder. I hope you guys enjoy a sweet one today.